Excuse me, this is the operator. This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Let's begin with roll call for those on the phone and on Adobe Connect. If at all possible, please do try to join both.
I'll do the roll call for you quickly, Greg. It's Gisela. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's call, we have George Kirikos, Roland Perry, James Bledel, Greg Aaron, Martin Sutton, Faisal Shah, Rod Rasmussen. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Glenda Sargeri, Marika Konings, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have apologies from Mike O'Connor. Thank you.
Thank you, Gisela. All right. Well, today's agenda is as follows. We're going to get some updates from our subgroups, cyber squatting, contracts, and spam phishing malware. We're then going to discuss the Seoul meeting. I'd like to get an idea of who's going to be there. And we have to provide an update to the council, so we'll talk about that today. Today I'd like to start by talking about the cyber squatting group. Two meetings ago, we kind of discussed a way forward since there was little to no progress being made in this group. One of the questions that came up was, are we really talking about inadequacies of UDRP, for example? So I want to either make some substantial progress on this topic or stop talking about it because it's been going around in circles for a while. James, you had evidenced some interest in the past in this group. What do you identify as the way forward?
Hi, Greg. Since our last meeting, we kind of decided that George Kirikos and I would go off on our own and see if we couldn't come back with something that was palatable to the group at large, and if so, we would check this box, if it were, and just move on. So that's exactly what George and I have done since our last call. We met once via telephone and a couple of email exchanges since then. Where we are is that essentially that for defining cyber squatting, we should stick to the definition as outlined in Section 4A and 4B of the UDRP. Now, there are some there was some discussion about borrowing from other areas as well. For example, the I believe it's the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, ACPA. There are some issues involved in borrowing from other legislation. First of all, it's jurisdictionally specific, and secondly, it seemed to be a bit unbalanced. For example, if we were going to borrow from one side of a definition, we should also borrow from those areas that try to outline what constitutes fair use or bad, lack of bad faith. And George posted some sections from the ACPA to that effect on the list. Finally, I think the third point is that if we are going to point a finger and say that the UDRP needs to be updated, revised, refined, or modified in any way, then that needs to be a separate question that this group can discuss whether or not recommendation for a revised UDRP should be made, and that should follow the prescribed PDP process as it currently exists, rather than trying to piggyback it into a cyber squatting definition or anti-cyber squatting PDP. So those were the three main points that that George and I arrived at. And George, please, if I've left something out or misstated your position on something, please jump in now.
George here, that was perfect.
Okay, so the three takeaways that we had, Greg: one, we should, unless we have a compelling reason, we should stick with the UDRP definition of cyber squatting, which is in Section 4 of the UDRP policy. Secondly, that any attempt to borrow from other language or other documents or other procedures or proceedings or legislation has to be balanced. It can't grab all of the components of UDRP, or I'm sorry, cyber squatting, and then not grab the components of fair use or lack of things that would not demonstrate bad faith. And then thirdly, that any attempts to refine, reform, or reconstruct the UDRP has to go through a separate process in its own right, because there's a whole host of different interested parties besides those and just focused on cyber squatting.
Okay. This is Greg. So as far as number three is concerned, the recommendation is if folks are interested in UDRP discussion, it would obviously need its own PDP, because that's a very complicated topic. Are you also saying that this group should not make a recommendation about UDRP?
My personal opinion, Greg, is that we should not. This is James speaking again. However, I'll leave that to the consensus of the group. I certainly could be in the minority on that respect. But I feel that, if we're starting off with an issues report, going to council, requesting the PDP on its own merits, as opposed to, bundling it with existing efforts.
Okay. Thank you. That was very clear. Okay. I'd like to open up James's comments to the larger group. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Faisal?
Yeah. So, James, let me just see if I understand. Are you saying basically that we're just going to pull out small five and small six as evidence of bad faith in connection with the definition? Is that what we're talking about here?
Are you talking about the UDRP small five and small six, or?
Well, what I'm looking at here in terms of what we've put together, I guess, in our discussions, small one through small, or small one through small four, that are bad faith, and then small five, and then small six come from the ACPA. Are we saying that in terms of how we're moving forward, are we just pulling those two out as evidence of bad faith, and everything else pretty much is the way it stands right now? I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out where we're going from here.
Yeah, Faisal, I think I remember you're referencing the email threads between yourself, myself, and Mike Rodenbaugh from September. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay, let me pull that up real quickly here and reference those. I think that you are correct, and I think that Mike made a pretty effective case that those elements are key into what's considered by a UDRP panelist or a UDRP provider. But I think that one of the questions that we had was whether the differing providers defined them consistently, or if there were room for interpretation within the different providers. So I'm just trying to pull that up and speak at the same time, so I apologize if I'm rambling a bit here, but I'm trying to kill for time. But for the most part, yes, I think that if we're going to pull up those additional sections of the the ACPA or any other areas, we should probably, one, make sure that they are very tightly and uniformly and consistently applied. And I don't think that we can necessarily always say that with the UDRP providers. And secondly, I think, George, if you want to post the link to the area also from the ACPA that balanced those three parameters, I think that those are also a necessary component, and those would kind of go hand in hand. I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but I think that once we started to go outside of the UDRP, we had to be very careful that we were that what we were bringing back into the definition was both uniformly applied and had its corresponding counterbalance.
Okay.
So I guess we didn't just throw them overboard. We looked at those as well and tried to find where they were linked to as well in other parts of the legislation. And I think George has that up now.
You know, the only thing I would say is when examiner is looking at whether something is a cyber squatting domain name or not, they do look to whether or not the registrant has registered other names, for their own personal gain or for their own commercial gain, names that have to do with Nike and have to do with Yahoo and names that sit there that should not be used for their, I guess they're assuming it's for their intent of selling it back to the owner or whatnot. So that, I have to say that, in terms of Rule 6, those are the kinds of those are the things to look at. And I'm just trying to figure out if you guys considered ways of actually improving these sections as opposed to like you say, James, just throwing it out.
This is Greg. I have a question. Are patterns of past behavior like that listed as criteria in the EDRP? I mean, I guess they're used as evidence of bad faith, right?
Right. So the use, it's not determinative. I mean, it's not something that they say, okay, absolutely, this is what's going on. I mean, that's why, those services that some of the companies provide, like Reverse and Wiz, that provides all the Whois information regarding what other domain names are owned by particular registrars, can be really important, because it just shows that there is that pattern, and they are accumulating domain names that clearly aren't names that they plan on using themselves offensively, but these are names they are going to use for personal gain by somehow trying to leverage them. So I guess to some extent, yeah, I think that there is a pattern that's looked at, but it's not the thing that they look at. It's just one factor.
Okay. I see George's hand raised.
I just wanted to point out that the existing EDRP actually does say, provided that you have engaged in a pattern of such conduct in 3-2, again, demonstrating bad faith. So it is kind of already there. It's just that, taking the language from the EDRP, from the ACPA without any counterbalancing measures would be very problematic.
Okay.
As I demonstrated in the link that I posted.
Okay. And I see James's hand.
Yeah, and I think that, Faisal, and certainly open to other opinions on this, but, one of the things that George and I set out to do was to try to separate what those elements that would clearly come down hard on the scales and cause someone to lose a UDRP versus those things that would constitute a very narrow and tight definition of cyber squatting. So, for example, if I went out and got one single domain name that fit the parameters described here in the UDRP, I would still be a cyber squatter, even though I did not necessarily have, a whole portfolio of domains that met that criteria. And in the latter case, that would certainly expedite my loss of those names through the UDRP, but it wouldn't necessarily add a whole lot of value to the definition. And I don't know if that makes sense. It's a pretty subtle distinction that we were trying to uphold.
Okay. Thank you, James. This is Greg. So I have a question. I would like to drive this towards some sort of a resolution. What I've heard so far is that, you know, this whole issue of cyber squatting has been raised as a potential abuse. The conversation does keep turning back to UDRP. Other than UDRP, are there any recommendations that this group wants to make regarding cyber squatting? Let's put aside UDRP for a minute, and we can come back to it, as James and George have said. That UDRP conversation may need to take a separate path. But other than UDRP, are there any recommendations that this group or anyone in the group wants to put forward regarding cyber squatting? I'm not. James, is your hand up?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, new hand raised. And to answer your question, Greg, my personal opinion is that stepping away from this subgroup a little bit and speaking as an individual, I believe that UDRP is a tool and probably the most appropriate tool from a policy perspective to address cyber squatting, although registries and registrars may be doing things on their own as well. But from a policy perspective, the policy exists, and it is appropriately applicable to cyber squatting. Now, whether we want to discuss the efficacy of that tool and whether or not that tool needs to be sharpened or maintained or revised to keep track with, you know, current practices and things like that, I think that that is definitely one of the recommendations that this group can make. But I don't think that... at least from my perspective, I don't see a large demand for a new set of tools.
Okay. So, if I may, your statement is that UDRP is the tool that is used to deal with the issue. And recommendations about its efficacy is, you know, something that could be possibly discussed. But you yourself are not recommending other tools.
I'm not recommending. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Martin?
Hi, thanks. I think that's a good point actually raised by James in terms of how efficient it is. I must admit, personally, I use it as the last resort, really. I think the problem here is that there is masses of it out there troubling brand holders, that we can't take every case to UDRP, so it's on very rare occasions that I'd even bother going to that extent. So there is a massive abuse out there that exists which goes untreated. So I suppose I would like to see something else beyond UDRP listed as an area to explore, but I don't have the answer.
Greg, can I, this is James. Can I just respond to that really quickly, or I can... Martin, I think you're correct, but I think that type of work can be achieved through any future revision of the UDRP. If you're saying that, you know, it's last resort because it's too long, it's too expensive, it's too fuzzy in its outcomes or things like that. I mean, those are things that could be cleaned up in a revision of the UDRP rather than creating a new policy. That's just my response to that.
Well, that's fair enough, yeah. No, I agree with that.
Okay. I'm sorry, I think Faisal was next.
Yeah, actually, I just wanted to echo what Martin was saying. In fact, I took the words out of my mouth, and I think UDRP is expensive, and it is it falls short of being an effective remedy. And I think that, I think if it's possible, we should be. There have to be other tools, or maybe there's ways of coming up with other tools. And I don't know if this group it's about coming up with those tools, but recommending that maybe there's other ways of handling the cyber squatting problem in addition to making the UDRP more effective. So I'm kind of coming alongside Martin on this.
Okay. George?
I'd like to echo what James said earlier. I'd also like to make a couple of other points that the amount of cyber squatting measured by the UDRP has tended to fall in the last few years. If you look at it as a percentage of the names registered totally across all GTLDs, also if you look at it on an absolute basis, I think the number actually fell last year and definitely has fallen this year. Secondly, people are free to pursue civil remedies. Like, they don't necessarily need a special policy from ICANN in order to counter trademark infringement. As long as the who is accurate, you know, there's courts around the world that can handle this and have handled it for, you know, Verizon, Dell, Disney, et cetera. There's no special need for a policy for ICANN when people do have alternatives. For example, if somebody's selling a counterfeit pair of Nike shoes on eBay or Craigslist, we don't have an ICANN policy for that. people, you know, are free to take it to court, and that should be the same for trademark infringement. So the solution should be more in the pattern of trying to make WHOIS more accurate, in other words, so that people can pursue those remedies themselves in a civil manner.
Okay. Anything else, George?
No, that was it.
Okay. Martin, did you raise your hand again?
I did, if I may. Am I jumping the queue?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. George, I do agree with that point on the who is side of things, because I think that comes into the equation a lot more as we look through some of the abuse types through this process. That would be an ideal area to explore separate to UDRP. The only issue I have still got when we talk about this, it's very simple to say yes, that there are mechanisms in place, but the onus is always on the trademark holder. So the ease at which it allows itself to proliferate across the internet in terms of cyber squatting abuse, it's uncontrollable for trademark holders. You know, we can only pay attention to the highest risk elements, because these are not our day jobs. So just to put a balance on that, you know, fair enough, there are mechanisms out there that we can utilize, including UDRP, but the fact is people can get away with this activity and remain anonymous and pay nothing apart from $5 for a domain. So I just think that's worth to bear in mind at this stage.
I see James's hand and George's hand. James, did you want to comment?
Yeah, just very quickly. I wanted to mention that as far as alternatives, you know, particularly when we're talking about incomplete or fraudulent WHOIS information, there are policies existing for that, as well as stipulations and requirements and registration agreements. So, you know, perhaps in those types of situations, it's best to work with the registrar or the registry to get those corrected, or even ICANN compliance. So I agree with you that there are existing alternatives to that, and I think that Martin raised a very astute point relative to, you know, the barriers to entry for someone who wants to commit this type of action is very low versus the cost, expense, and diligence required to prevent it. And I think that the same, Martin, the same equation also holds true for registrars as well. And it goes back to the analogy versus the police department versus the fire department. Are you out there patrolling, looking for problems to, you know, prevent or deter those types of issues, or do you build a cost-effective and, rapid response mechanisms so that when the problem is detected and reported, you can clamp down on it very quickly? And I think that, you know, when we start talking about things that are prevalent on the Internet, I tend to gravitate towards the fire department approach, because I believe that, you know, in the long run, that's what that's what serves the community. But that's my opinion there.
Thank you, James. George?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that point about the barrier to entry, and I agree with what James just said. There's some the same thing can be said for other abuses too, like spam. It doesn't cost anything at all for anybody to become a spammer and send out, you know, 10 million emails for a dollar or two. So that problem exists not just for trademark infringement, but for all the other kinds of abuses as well. Typically, they're taking advantage of the economies of scale offered by electronic communications. And so, to some extent, you know, trademark holders can worry about the issue of, you know, death by a thousand cuts, that people can register thousands of variations of their marks. And I guess at some point they have to start doing a cost-benefit analysis of, you know, exactly how much traffic are these domains actually receiving, and, you know, are they as big a worry as they, you know, set them out to be. In some cases they are, like Verizon obviously gained, you know, they say tens of millions of visitors a year by going after the typos of their names. But for other people, it's probably a lot smaller than that. And also, there are other means to go about it, to go about finding remedies rather than the courts. For example, Google and Yahoo are the dominant pay-per-click providers. People could obviously file their trademarks with Google and Yahoo and get the names turned off if they were being sent to pay-per-click monetization methods. I guess the more serious concerns are when people do it for banks, for example, and you have, you know, phishing of banking credentials, which I guess is Martin's background. But there you don't even necessarily have to do it with a trademark infringing name. You can do it with any domain name. So it goes back to the broader question of phishing in that specific example. That's what I wanted to say. I guess we also have a few more people that joined the call according to the Adobe, so we might want to introduce them.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay.
Sorry, I've got my hand up.
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
Greg. Yeah, so I'll keep putting this on mute because I've got lots of background noise here. I think that again, there's some good points there. On the phishing side, I tend to forget about cyber squatting in terms of phishing. Phishing is actually more easier to identify, you know, the intention and deal with it. So those that there's very good methods of approaching that, although perhaps not uniform across all the players across the globe. My concerns are, for instance, where there are large numbers of domains that infringe on a brand like ours, where we do not see much evidence of malicious activity. These are things that go under the radar, so there could just be a very bland holding page on the site saying under construction, but there's MX records set up, and you don't know what traffic they're trying to do on the back of that domain. It's all hidden. And when they start targeting individual users with faxes, which then say, well, you can contact us by this telephone number or by this email address to build up a relationship, these are quite difficult to pick up. And I would say, again, you know, it's very difficult then for end users, one, to identify they're being lured into a scam, and secondly, where to report it to and get something done about it. And we only pick up these randomly, if you like. So I think there's a problem where there's a... I agree that we have to do some cost-benefit analysis, and we certainly approach it in a way which says biggest risk, let's deal with it. The rest of it, we haven't got the resources or the time or the money to manage thousands upon thousands of variations across all the GTLDs and the CCTLDs. And what my concern is that the end users are then affected by approaches which appear to be coming from a bank, but we can't even pick them up on radars that we would traditionally use for phishing or malware related scams. So I just flagged that up again because I think, you know, we've spent quite a lot of time on definitions here, but in practice there's lots of going on out there that the UDRP, for instance, will not address. Certain other policies, the who is, the emphasis on who is earlier, you know, these are all good things and could end up helping all of these problematic behind-the-scenes issues that I frequently see. That's my lot.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Martin. I see George's hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, George here, just wanted to add that, you know, there are a couple other ways that people can go after the problem instead of just trademark infringement. You know, the banks can focus on better education of their customers, things like, you know, having EV, SSL certificates, things like that, that can educate their consumers on, you know, how to identify these frauds. Because I guess that's where the fraudsters are really taking advantage of people. They're just going after the least educated consumers. And, you know, we could spend, you know, we could eliminate, for example, all the trademark infringement in the world, and then somebody could simply do it on a subdomain. So, you know, it's how we get the best results for the amount that we invest in terms of trying to tackle these problems.
Thank you, George. Faisal?
Yeah, I totally understand what George is saying, but I think most of that again puts the burden back on the trademark holder, and makes it either expensive or difficult, or you know, there's nothing. You know, I think we should be finding tools that are not as expensive that we can use to help trademark holders in connection with cyber squatting, in addition to the EDRP, because again, like we have been talking about this entire time, it's really not that efficient, and even state court remedies that George has talked about are expensive as well. I mean, if we take it from the EDRP, I mean, talk about, you know, expensive there. If you're talking about thousands of domains at, you know, $2,500 a pop, that could be pretty expensive for a particular company. And then when you start thinking about, you know, $10,000 for an ACPA action, that's even more expensive. And then maybe, you know, issues and costs in other countries. So I'm just thinking that there should be some other tools that are not quite as expensive and maybe more effective for brand holders in addition to the UDF. I guess that's where I keep trying. That's where I keep coming down.
Okay, this is Greg. We're about 35 minutes into this conversation, and I would like to wrap it up for today. The discussion of this issue has been much more focused than it was earlier in the working group's life. What I need you guys to do is get on the wiki and put down your positions. If you have recommendations, please draft those and put them in the wiki. A lot of the discussion we've had has been around kind of what the issue and the background are, and I think we've gotten some good crystallization of what that is. You've been discussing how the UDRP works well, sometimes how it doesn't work well. You've enumerated some cases where you don't think the UDRP is effective or perhaps not applicable. Those kinds of things need to go into the issues and background sections. We must drive towards publication of an initial report, and I think the time for identifying the issues is now past. I think we've gotten to a point where we understand some of them. If you're interested in this topic, you've got to put something down on paper now. And I don't want to take time in the meetings because I think we've gotten through the issues. I need volunteers to flesh out those issue sections. We've already got a fair amount of material there. It needs to be shaped according to the last couple of conversations and some of the relevant threads. I also want to see recommendations. If you suggest that we need additional tools to deal with cyber squatting, please state that. If you believe that the UDRP is the appropriate tool, please state that. If you have any other additional ideas, please state those. So I'm hearing interest from George, Martin, Faisal, and James mainly. The four of you have been most engaged in this topic. Can I rely on the four of you individually or together to put material down on paper and drive towards something we can publish?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I know that we have the ICANN meeting coming up, and people's minds are starting to turn towards that, but we need to attach a timeline to this, just so it's all on the tops of our minds. What do you think is a reasonable time to have the issues, backgrounds, and recommendations sections filled in so that the group can read through them and measure levels of consensus? How long is it going to take, do you think? We've got ICANN basically the last week of this month. So do you think it would be around, let's see, when's the meeting after ICANN? November 9th? Do you think that's doable? That gives you the first week of November to recover from ICANN and do some touching up.
I think that's fine.
Okay, so the goal is to have the issues, background, and draft recommendations. And, of course, that means all of the recommendations that people want to put forward. They can be in tune with each other, or they could be in conflict with each other or whatever. But then that gives us something on paper that the entire group can come through. We'll measure levels and we'll rewrite as necessary. Okay, awesome. Long time coming, but I'm glad we're there. I'd like to move on to the next section, uniformity of contracts. What we discovered by going through the work that Barry and others have done is that there is no uniformity. But then the next question is, well, what does that mean? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? The group's task has been to understand if registration abuses are occurring that might be curtailed or better addressed if there was more uniformity. And the group is going to put some material on the wiki and flesh it out. So let us go to the wiki. And Barry's not on the call today. Is there anyone? And Mikey had to give his regrets for today. He's in transit. Is there anyone else in that subgroup that can tell us about where the wiki material is in terms of its process? It doesn't seem to be fleshed out. James, do you know? I don't see that the wiki's been filled in.
This is Marika. There is a document posted, and I'm trying to pull it up on the Adobe Connect, in which Barry has summarized the last meeting of the sub-team. I think it's at the top of the page.
Okay. Are you able to pull it up in Adobe?
Give me 2 seconds.
Okay.
Should be up now.
Okay, great. Okay. So the sub-team says it will not have capability to make true recommendations relative to what abuse provisions are required. We would not be in the proper position to define what the minimum baseline should be. And they say they want to discuss next steps and better understand the required effort at future meetings. We're missing some of the key participants from this group, though.
Greg, this is James.
Yeah.
Yeah, to speak to that, this is centered primarily on Rod Rasmussen's message to the list, and I want to point out that you skipped over the part that says without sufficient data. And Rod outlined essentially an approach or a methodology on how that data might be obtained in an earlier meeting or earlier email. And so I think that this group is saying that, yes, we're agreeing with Rod that without that quantifiable data, it would be difficult to make true recommendations on what the minimum baseline should be.
Okay, very good. And my skipping that section was completely inadvertent. Okay, so anyway, are we in a position to discuss this without Barry and Mikey on the call?
I'd rather have one or both of them.
I would also. All right. I think the action item remains to put this material on the wiki, though. And we're going to need them in the next meeting. I don't know offhand if they're planning to participate in the meeting at Seoul or not, but we'll ask.
Both have indicated that they'll be they won't be there in person, but they'll be participating remotely.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay. Next one is we'll have to pick that up next time. The next one is malware and botnets. I have put new material on the wiki as I promised, and Marika, that's on the malware/botnet control wiki.
Okay, I think I took the wrong one there. Just I need a few seconds to.
But yeah, we've got two separate topics. One is malware and botnets, okay. And the other one's.
All right, if you can already talk around it, I'll get the other one up there.
Spam phishing malware. One of the things that's been posted recently on the ICANN website is called the ERSR, which stands for Expedited Registry Security Request. This came directly out of the experience with Configure, which was a big part of our malware and botnet discussion. Basically, what happened was Configure was a large-scale threat that uniquely leveraged thousands of domain names. Initially, in .com.org, info, and biz, and .cn, later it expanded to include about 100 other registries as well, mostly ccTLDs. And basically what happened there was the registries and ICANN got together and said, okay, yeah, this is all something we're interested in dealing with. It's the right thing to do. Let's figure out a way to get it done, and then we'll regroup. And what people realized was that this kind of thing will probably happen again at some point. There will be a threat to the DNS, or there'll be a threat that could fall on a particular TLD or registry that would require the registry to take some defensive action. And we've basically everybody said, well, we need to be prepared and have process for the next time that happens. So the ERSR is the result. And in the description, I've posted a link to it. And basically, the ERSR says that when an issue like this comes up, the registry can go to ICANN, report it, and propose a mitigation effort. And ICANN can choose to waive or modify relevant contractual language for the duration of that incident or whatever is needed to deal with that incident. In the case of Configure, that meant some registries wanted to register the relevant domain names so criminals could not register and use them. So in some cases, those registries registered those names in a holding account. Normally, registries aren't allowed to register domain names for themselves, of course, so that was the waiver. Other registries chose to do it different ways. Some of them just blocked the names so they couldn't be registered, which doesn't exactly... That's kind of a more of a reserved name approach or a... it's not exactly a cessation of first come, first serve, but it sets aside some names that can't be put into the registry. Other registries said, what we'll do is let's let a white hat register those names, and we will agree to waive the fees. And then ICANN should also waive the ICANN fees on those. So that was another contractual accommodation. ERSR basically sets up a framework for the registry, and ICANN's legal and security staff to review these proposals and then get them checked off on. So there's process involved in it. So it's basically set up, and it's also fairly flexible. It doesn't say exactly how we're going to deal with things. That has to be figured out once you understand the threat that's come up. So basically it's a framework for going forward. It's been proposed as something to be available to the existing TLDs. The ERSR has also been inserted into the new draft applicant guidebook for new TLDs. So the ICANN staff has proposed that all the new TLDs to come would also be able to avail themselves of this. So first I want to ask if anybody has any questions about what the ERSR is and is designed to do. James, is that your hand?
Yeah, quick question, Greg, and I apologize. I've read this once, but that was quite, I think, when it first came out, and so this may be covered somewhere in the document, but the question is the ERSR designed to be a rapid stopgap measure, and that if, for example, the situation or the impetus that caused the ERSR to be raised in the first place becomes a long-term or ongoing problem, that it would be addressed through some other mechanism like an RCEP, or is it meant to be temporary?
Well, it's designed, I think it says, for the duration of the incident. Now, Conficker, for example, is an example of an ongoing incident in that Conficker's code continues to generate domain names, and if you want to continue to block those, that's an ongoing process. And it's going to depend on how long, you know, Conficker remains kind of out in the wild, perhaps. Now, but that said, it's a very well-defined set of domain names. We know how many are involved, and we know that they're kind of long, random-looking domain names for the most part that nobody's going to want, you know. So that's an ongoing one. Would a PDP be relevant to addressing Conficker specifically? I would suggest no, because it's very, you know, so it's fairly limited issue, well-defined issue. And now, we have no idea what other kinds of things are going to happen in the future. I think PDPs are most useful when there is a general and systemic question that comes up, right? That's usually what our PDPs are about. Does that make sense?
I think so. My only question relative to ERSR would be whether or not this could be a backdoor for temporarily permanent changes. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is something that, you know, is needed in a hurry and is quickly addressed through an ERSR, but then because of the duration of the incident goes from weeks and months to years, it becomes, you know, a fixture on the landscape. And I'm just trying to understand, you know, where that transition point goes from an emergency action to more formal actions like an RCEP or a PDP. And I don't have the answer. I'm just asking that relative to ERSR.
I don't know if anybody knows yet, because we don't have any good examples other than Conficker. I have to assume that if we get a lot of similar events, or if something gets really big, then somebody would have the option of raising the issue and saying, this is now become something that needs to be looked at, you know, more from a policy standpoint or what have you. I think that option would be open. So anyway, what's happened since we started our work in this group is this new thing has come about. I've drafted a note about describing what ERSR is, and at this point, I don't have any additional recommendations to put into the malware and botnet control section. I haven't heard from Rod yet, but I don't have any because this would help me as a registry figure out how to deal with, you know, there's a large-scale issue. This would give me some options. So I'd like to hear if anybody else has any other recommendations to be slotted into this section. And that's an open question now and for the next couple of weeks, of course.
Sure. This is Rod. I heard my name used in vain there, so I guess I'll play that. Or maybe not vain, but... and unfortunately, I'm driving rather than in front of a computer, so I can't raise my hand. I think we had a little bit of an email exchange on this, Barry. I think this does, you know, the ESR, ERS, ERS, RSRs, whatever it is, gets to the heart of the matter for large-scale incidents. So the only question I have remaining at this point is, what do we do about small-scale stuff? And does that fit in this category or not? This category was kind of created to address these large-scale things like Conficker, I think. And then we have another category that's the phishing, spam, et cetera, which may be more germane to the small-scale botnet stuff or not. We've got labels on here. We have to figure out how we want to work that out. But, for example, currently the botnet that's doing the avalanche attacks has got 5 CNC domain names attached to it in the code that's underneath it, 2 of which are registered, 3 are not. They all happen to be COM, I think. But anyways, there's some law enforcement saying hands off on those right now. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that how do you respond to that from a policy perspective versus an incident perspective, and then you've got all kinds of other botnets and things being controlled by domain names or potentially controlled by domain names on a very much smaller scale. You don't need to have this process to, you know, warn lots of registries all concurrently on what's going on. So that's an open area, I think, for us to figure out how we want to deal with that. Whether we deal with it in this topic area or the other one.
I agree, actually. This is Greg. And that provides us a segue into the separate place where we were looking at other malicious conducts like phishing, malware, and spam, the smaller day-to-day kinds of incidents that happen on the Internet all the time.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly appropriate to cover it there. I just want to make sure we cover it and don't kind of skip it because the natures of the two different things are the same, relatively, you know, just a scale issue.
Yeah, I agree. My proposal is everybody take a look at what I've written on the wiki in the malware/botnet area, which kind of deals with these large-scale threats that are so large that they would require a registry itself to respond and possibly get a contractual exemption to deal with it. and then separately segue into the other area, which is basically where we're looking at these kinds of malicious or criminal conducts like malware and phishing and so forth. And Rod, I think you've touched upon an important question, which is these are things that often have to do with domain names, but the question is, what's the role for policymaking? What are the issues? So let's segue to that then. Marika, are you able to bring up the malware phishing spam wiki?
The one that was just, you mean this one?
Yeah. Okay, we've got notes. Yeah, it's pretty much the same. What's on the wiki and what's on that document. Okay. To recap the previous conversations, there was some, so I'm just going to read this. We discussed how these abuse categories relate to the scope of the working group's activities and GNSS policymaking. As these abuses occur after domain names were registered, some suggested that these abuse categories fall outside the scope of the working group as its focus is on registration abuse. Some suggested that only if you were able to determine at the time of registration that a domain name will be used for phishing, spam, or malware, it might be considered registration abuse. Some argued that it will not be possible to determine at the time of registration whether it will be used for phishing, spam, or malware, while others pointed out that based on who is registering the domain name, how this is being done, e.g. which name servers are being used, use of stolen credentials, etc., it might be possible. The point was raised that a problem with assessing what a domain registration will be used for at the time of registration still requires speculation about future intent, which can never be 100% accurate. Some propose that there is the ability to accurately predict or accurately assess intent at the time of registration. I'm sorry, that if there is an ability to accurately predict or accurately assess intent at the time of registration, it should be part of the recommendations made by the group relating to registration abuse. The issue of false positives and how to deal with those is raised in this context. So the point there was we're talking about registration abuse rather than use abuse and how those intersect. There's the issue of, at the time of registration, can you figure out whether it's going to be used for a malicious purpose or not? It was pointed out that as in the next bullet that as a business practice, many registries or registrars delete massive numbers of domain registrations that have never been used for phishing or spam, phishing malware, etc., when they discover that the person or organization that has registered these domains is actually using at least some of the domains for that purpose. In these cases, the registrant has already broken terms of service agreement. Another question would be whether or not ICANN should get involved in that process or whether this working group should make any recommendations to that end. It was suggested that an ICANN approach might inject uniformity where flexibility is often required, as it might tie the hands of registries and registrars and reduce or limit their options, or how they can or cannot act in those situations. It was suggested that best practices or minimum standards could be explored. The importance of due process is also noted. So if I may, that bullet was about the fact that some registries and most registrars, I think, if not all, already have some contractual language or terms of use about domain names. And at this time, they do use those to suspend domain names. for these kinds of infringements. The question is whether there might be more uniformity in that, or whether that uniformity might be a good thing or a bad thing. Next bullet is, someone noted that in certain instances, legitimate domain name registrations are hijacked and used for purposes such as phishing, malware, and spam. Any policy or recommendation should not impact those that are innocent bystanders, such as blocking future domain registrations. In the case of phishing, 80% of phishing domains are compromised or hacked, with the legitimate registrant not being aware of those activities. Next bullet is, taking into account the scope question for this working group to focus on registration process, it suggested that verification of users might be a potential approach to consider, suitable for policy development. Another issue was suggested is systemic abuse by resellers, which goes back to how registrars deal with various agents. It was pointed out that with regard to GNSO policy, making these categories might be out of scope for GNSO consensus policy development, but other measures, such as e.g. best practices, could be possible outcomes. Okay, so those were the substantive comments that have been made so far. I have a question, which is, we've been calling this one phishing, spam, and malware. Should we call this something that gets to the heart of it, which is malicious conduct involving domain names, or something like that? Is there any merit in that? There might be things outside of phishing, spam, and malware which are equally applicable, for example. I'd like to throw that question out. Rod, do you have any opinion on that? Are we missing bad activities, for example?
Well, I mean, certainly things like, you know, the classic example that everybody throws in there is child pornography. I guess the malicious uses in the eye of the beholder. You have, you know, all the issues that people bring up is what's illegal where, in what jurisdictions. I think if you call it malicious use and specify examples that are fairly universally agreed upon, then you might be able to avoid those issues. But you do kind of web this, you know, get this semantics argument rolling if you just have a broad label.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting tired of semantics arguments.
Yeah, and we have those issues of jurisdiction when we're talking about malware or spam or anything else anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see Martin's hand.
Sorry, late to the mute button. Yes, just to echo Rod's words there as well. Don't really want to go into lots of definition type processes. One thing, I just wonder if I could put out a question here in terms of GTLDs. There's this remark with regards to, you know, proactively identifying domains that are likely to have the intent for abuse. I just wonder whether that extends across all GTLDs, so that there's some proactive registries and registrars out there, but across the GTLD space, I wonder if the same information is shared. So if you do have somebody breaking the terms and conditions set out within your agreement, whether that can then forfeit their registrations across any other GTLDs, or potentially one to examine down the road.
Well, that's an interesting question. Most of what happens now is according to whether someone has violated a terms of service or a contract. And a registrar may determine a particular registrant has done that. But but can that be shared, or should it be shared to other registrars or other registries? I mean, that's, I think that's up to the registrar. And if I was an attorney, I would, at a, you know, at a registrar, I would want to make decisions based upon my own contract.
So does that go back to uniformity of contracts?
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking. Should...
Well, I'm just thinking about some of the fraudulent type activities. Ignore domain name space for the moment. I'm just thinking about fraud within the banking environment. There's a lot of collaboration amongst other financial institutions, so we know what's going on, share the new types of fraud that are going on, and where appropriate, there is a certain level of data share and giving between a select group of players so that we can tackle fraud effectively. I'm just wondering, in some of the particular circumstances that we're talking about where GTLDs are viewed as a good resource for fraudsters to conduct deployment of malware or phishing attacks and such like, where there's some data elements within, for instance, who is that are going to be the same and can be checked across all of the GTLDs, whether there is some proactive work that can be done in that space. So it cuts out more at a network level what's going on rather than waits for events to occur and all treated in their own separate way further down the line, which is normally when end users are affected. So I'm just trying to think here, is, you know, building into some of the ideas where there are good practices already undertaken by some of the registries and registrars, whether to extend that out so that for GTLDs, where there is a contract with ICANN, that there's something that could be built in there or looked at, investigated, whatever, to think about best ways to share information and block out bad actors.
George?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on George Griegel here. Follow up on that idea from Martin. Was he kind of advocating a risk-based approach where you can identify certain people or certain registrants as high risk, kind of like you do in the insurance industry, you know, identifying people with, you know, pre-existing conditions and charging them more and being able to classify people according to their risk? Is that kind of what you're advocating? I can support if you allow people to mitigate that risk, for example, by sharing, you know, doing WHOIS verification and other things to kind of whitelist themselves or signal to the market that they are a good actor.
Yeah, I think it's more where there is distinct evidence of foul play. So there is always a lead. It's probably not at the point of registration. There is some activity that takes place which reveals a bad actor, but some reverse who is checking then reveals all the domains across GTLDs, probably lots more CCTLDs, but we'll ignore those for now, where there can be some methods built in to say, okay, once you've broken the terms and conditions for this type of category, say, okay, phishing, then all of your domains that you hold in your portfolio that we can identify are then suspended, or some kind of action can be taken against those across all the GTLDs.
So, Martin, this is Greg. So the idea would be, once an individual is proved to be a problem, your question is, can all their domain names be identified across the various TLDs and registrars that they use,
yeah,
and then have all of them take action against that party.
Yep. It's similar to me going to legal department saying, can we put an injunction on somebody from ever using the internet? I know it'll be very difficult to impose, but there are ways that we can work through some of these, but it just reveals to me some of the ways that we tackle fraud issues is through data sharing, where we're able then to, as George alluded to, we can risk assess some of these, or we can block them out depending on the severity and the proof. So where we've got distinct types of threats, we can work through some of those to an idea where, you know, bad actor's been revealed, it's for this type of malicious behavior, and therefore we can cross-check against all other top-level GTLD domains that are held by that individual and take action against them all on block, rather than, you know, all they'll do is just shift their business to all the other domains that they've got available to them.
Okay.
And there could be the potential for a blacklist as well, but they'll always go under another name.
Thank you, Mark. Now, I see that James had posted a note in the dialogue box. And he said, once we use the term conduct, does that not imply post-registration or use, e.g. use issues? James, do you want to flesh that out?
Briefly, Greg, but going back to your proposed category definition for these issues, you mentioned something malicious conduct, and I thought that the that we should possibly stay away from the word conduct, because that essentially comes down pretty heavily on the question of whether or not this is a registration abuse or a use abuse issue, and anything that you move under the heading of conduct, you know, immediately settles that question.
Well, isn't that one of the central issues that we're faced with? A domain name is in these kinds of problems we're looking at, phishing and malware and so malware distribution and so forth. The domain name can be registered, but it's not actually a problem until it's used. The issue is that in some cases, I think we're worried about that the bad guy's definitely going to use it because he's proven that he is a bad actor before. So the question is, are you moving against this person because you have a pretty good idea that he's going to do something bad, and why should we wait until it happens? Is that really the issue?
Yeah, I think if it is, Greg, I think that we want to state that. I'm sorry, this is James speaking. If it is, then we want to state that deliberately rather than making a categorical statement. So that's fine.
Right. Okay. Well, this is good. We're getting down to the core of the issue, I think. We're trying to, at least.
Right.
It reminds me of that old joke where the guy goes into the doctor's office and he says, "Doctor, it hurts when I do this," and he hits himself on the head, and the doctor says, "Well, don't do that." In some cases, in my experience, you're pretty sure that a particular person may do something bad because they've done it before, and it's frustrating as a responder. I'll state this as my personal opinion. It's frustrating as a responder in certain cases where you know that somebody's going to do something bad with a domain name because of their past history, and why then wait for them to do it? After that, the damage has been done and users have been hurt. I will say that those cases where you're really sure are relatively few. Where you have a repeat offender. Rod can tell you about the Avalanche gang, for example, of fishers who make very distinctive registrations, and you know who's behind them, and you know what they're going to do with them. The question is, should ICANN have a policy that addresses these, or are these cases already addressable, I think? And is more uniformity needed, or is there something we need to do to make things more clear, or something like that? I think that's the issue with these kinds of problems like phishing and malware distribution. So what are your thoughts?
Are you directing that to James directly or the group at large?
Anybody.
Okay, because Martin's ahead of me in the queue.
Sorry, I left that one standing. Sorry. I'll take that down.
Okay. All right, I see Margie's hand.
Actually, with a separate topic, we keep going back to this topic of whether we're allowed to look at use as part of the work of this group, and I thought, you know, from some of the presentations that I've made over the past, that we're not limited to looking at only abuses that relate to registration. We just, the only thing that the charter really identified is that we weren't going to, or at least we weren't worried about abuse that was solely related to use. But that doesn't mean that you're not allowed to look at use. So I just wanted to, you know, at least address that topic, that we don't need to be that restrictive.
Yes, you're reminding us that use is a factor that may be considered.
So it's not off limits. It's just, you know, what the charter really clarified was that we can't only look at use. You know, that if it's solely related to use, that's a separate topic.
Right. I think the other issue maybe in the back of the mind is that in the issues report, General Counsel said it's out of scope for policy to address uses in a certain fashion. I have to go back to the exact language that they pointed out.
Yeah, and I guess we could take a look at that, but I don't recall it being that restrictive. I think what we were trying to get at is we're not trying to, this isn't meant to be purely content. So if use of the domain name that's purely content and it has nothing to do with the registration, then that's probably off limits, and we can certainly go back to the issues report and then look at the language. But that's that's not saying that we're not able to look at use at all, which we're talking about over the last 10 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. James, I see your hand up still.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and take that down because I know we're getting close on time.
Yeah, we are actually. All right, let's pick this issue up again in the next meeting, which will be in Seoul. I think a lot of us will be participating remotely. Could I have a show of hands of who will be attending the Seoul meeting in person?
This is a virtual hand up from Rod.
Okay, Rod will be there. Margie, Marika, James, Phil, Mark, Faisal, Robert. I will not be there. George will not be there. I don't think Mikey's going to be there. So we'll have a few members at least.
There's another virtual hand up from Roland, who's accidentally closed his browser.
Okay, so Roland, you will be there in person?
I'll be in the meeting all week in person, yeah.
Okay. All right, so we'll have decent participation in person. Others, including myself, will join remotely. Since I'll be joining remotely, Marika had said she would help with the logistics of recognizing speakers and so forth. So we'll figure that out. One of the things we have to do is present an update to council. And just this morning there was a note from Glenn about an invitation to do that. So I have to read that invitation from Aubrey. I think what I'll probably end up doing this week is work with Marika to do a summary. Marika, you had kindly offered your time to help put a slide deck together.
Yes. Yes, correct. And maybe just to add to that, because one of the objectives of that update would be as well to brief some of the new council members on some of the work that's ongoing. So it would be a bit as well of a more in-depth explanation probably on, you know, what the objective of this working group is. And I think some slides we'll still have from some of the previous meetings. So I can
okay. Okay, great. Do you, how many new members will be coming onto the council? Do you know offhand?
At least, of course, the three new NCSG appointees. There's one new NOMCOM member. I think there's two at least new in the other groups, and I think some still need to confirm. So I think at least six, seven members that will be new.
Okay, great. Okay, well, we'll work on that over the course of the next week or so. And why don't we keep people updated on the list about that? And the meeting time has been posted up for everybody and the room number. This time it's not first thing in the morning. So thanks to the staff for obtaining a slightly more civilized time, I guess. Also, this time slot does not interfere with the ESAC meeting, which is the case for the last two meetings. So if you're interested in ESAC, you can not have a conflict. That's good. the format of the SOL meeting can be pretty much the same as it was last time, which was the first part will be continuation of our discussions amongst the members. We might decide to use the slide deck also as an orientation. And as in previous meetings, then we open up to hear questions and feedback from the community. So in the latter part of the meeting, we'll do that and record any comments and questions that people have. I think that's about it. Are there any other things that we should think about for the meeting? Marika, the remote participation has been pretty good over the last couple of meetings. Do you know if we'll have video coverage of this in Adobe?
Not that I'm aware of. I know that was run in previous meetings as a test for some meetings, but I don't think it has been. It's going to be across the board yet. I don't know. Glenn, do you know if Glenn is still on the call? I think she might have dropped, but as far as I'm aware, there's no video coverage for this meeting. I think we just have the Adobe Connect line and the telephone line.
Okay. Okay, cool. After Seoul, then, the next meeting would be November 9th and then 23rd. Which is the Monday before the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday. So we're locked in for our next three meetings. I haven't heard from anyone that there are any major conflicts as far as those three meetings. So anyway, as we come up at the end of the meeting, we do have a few action items that we agreed to today. I'll write those up and send them out to the list. Especially we need to do work on the wikis for uniformity of contracts and cyber squatting. And we will circle around to those at the SOL meeting. And does anybody have any last thoughts before we conclude for today? Going once, going twice? Okay, if not, we will adjourn, and we'll have our next meeting in conjunction with Seoul. So thanks for your continued good work, and hope to converse with you on the list before Seoul. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.
Thank you, Louise.